Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Do you watch cartoons? If you do, you might recognize the voices of our two featured guests. First, there's Elijah Wood, who plays the leading role of Mumbles, the dancing penguin, in the animated film Happy Feet.
It's just like singing with your body.
It's just one big old foot after the other. That's it.
Ooh.
Yeah, see?
Well, that feels good.
Then, perhaps at the other end of the family-friendly spectrum, there's Les Claypool. Les is every aspiring bass player's worst nightmare, because everyone wants to play like him and no one can figure out how. Les is the longtime frontman for the band Primus, but he's even better known for his contribution to the world of cartoons.
I'm going down south, I'm gonna have myself a time.
Friendly faces everywhere, humble folks without temptation.
Going down south, I'm gonna leave my woes behind.
Ample parking day or night, Plymouth Burning Party
never. And on up south,
yes, Les Claypool wrote the theme song for the R-rated cartoon series South Park. He'll be playing live for us with his almost-but-not-quite acoustic partnership, the duo De Twang. That's later. But first... Actor Elijah Wood often has multiple projects going on, the FX comedy series Wilfred, his own production company, and, of course, starring in feature films. To a generation of movie fans, he'll always be Frodo from the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but Elijah Wood is also a big music fan, which I think probably came in handy with his new movie Grand Piano, in which he plays a famous but troubled classical pianist. Elijah Wood, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much.
So you are a music fan. What about classical music?
Classical music is something it is a sea for which I have not dove into yet. You know, it's
what
like
a tortured metaphor that is.
Well, I think, you know, I often think about musical genres as being, you know, you could sort of attach it like a sea. Mm-hmm. I've jumped into the sea of jazz. I spent a lot of time researching jazz and getting into jazz. But classical is something that is—it's so massive that it's slightly daunting, to be honest. And there are so many multiple recordings of classical compositions. I wouldn't even know where to start. But it is something that I'd love to jump into eventually.
Well, you found yourself right smack in the middle of it in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, literally.
Yeah.
Most of the movie, it's a thriller. Most of it takes place during a concert, a classical, you know, an orchestral concert,
yes.
Piano concerto, you're the soloist.
Yes.
Who is Tom Selznick?
Tom Selznick is a young, genius piano player who 5 years prior to the film had played sort of an impossible piece and botched it in front of a lot of people. And as a result of that experience, it was traumatic. He has developed stage fright and he hasn't played in 5 years. So the film picks up with him returning to the stage after that five-year hiatus. And when he sits down to play, he starts looking through his score and sees that there's written notes in his score and that he must play a perfect set, otherwise he and his wife will be killed. And that's the beginning of the premise of the film.
And while this is happening, there is what looks to be an actual orchestra on the stage around you. I mean, the set piece is pretty extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. The stage was built, so we didn't actually film it at a real concert hall. We built that whole section that you see looking directly at it was built on a stage just outside of Barcelona. And that orchestra was there playing along with the PA system, which had the music, which was pre-recorded, playing for all of us to play along to effectively.
Mm-hmm. But so you really, that's a real orchestra.
It's a real orchestra.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is a clip from the film starring Elijah Wood. The film is called Grand Piano, directed by Eugenio Mira. The music actually is by Victor Reyes.
Correct.
Although it's credited to various composers during the course of the film.
It is.
And in this scene, Elijah's character, Tom Selznick, is attempting to play without making a mistake while his tormentor is talking to him through an earpiece that he's delivered to him.
Look above your head. Watch carefully. I want you to see this.
No.
Keep it together. Keep playing, Tom. If you don't pull it together in 1 second, you'll be shot. Keep your fingers on the piano and your mind on the music. This'll teach you how to focus. Steady. Good. Now make your conductor think everything's okay, or he'll be next. Tom, feeling better?
Why? Why did you kill him?
Never seen a dead body before, have you? How do you think you can be a great artist with so little life experience? See, I've taught you in a way Patrick never could, which means you're ready now.
What?
Ready for what, though?
Indeed. Is that
Elijah Wood is my guest on Soundcheck, and you heard Elijah playing this mythical... Who's the composer there?
Patrick Godereau.
Okay, that's who is Tom Selznick's mentor and
correct.
Who has recently died.
That's right.
And has left behind this magnificent piano. The film is called Grand Piano, and it opens on March 7th. And now... First of all, I liked the movie. I found the idea preposterous that a pianist could be both, you know, enduring all of this in his ear while playing this incredibly difficult and thorny music at the same time.
Yes.
But you were completely convincing as a pianist. Do you play the piano?
Thank you. I don't. I mean, that's sort of half true. I mean, I took lessons when I was a child, like many kids do. So from the ages of 10 to about 14, on and off, I was taking lessons. But I stopped, and I did not go back to the instrument. But I sort of retained the basics. Uh-huh. So when it came to work on the film... Obviously, the music in the film is far more complicated in terms of tempo and technique than I'd ever experienced in my life. But I had the basic rudiments to at least have an understanding of how that would start. And I worked for about 3 weeks with a coach in Los Angeles prior to going to Barcelona. And, you know, the way that the film is structured, it was created – Eugenio Mira, the director, basically made an animatic of the entire music set piece of the film. So 80% of the film effectively in animatic form, all timed to music. And within that, there was a very specific roadmap as to which parts of the score you would be seeing my face and hands at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave me a very specific roadmap in terms of what I really needed to learn and pay attention to, which – made it far more accessible, because if I had tried to encapsulate the entire, you know, of all the pieces of music, it would have been impossible.
Right. There's one kind of tracking shot that starts behind you, and I'm sitting there thinking, all right, so he's not playing. He's just, you know, we're watching a body double or something, because the hands are in all the right spots.
Right.
But then as the tracking shot comes in, it's clearly you. So that's one of those parts where you knew where to put your hands and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
All right. Grand Piano is the name of the name of the film, opening March 7th. And so the one of the keys to the story is this piece, which is considered unplayable.
Yes. La Cinquette.
La Cinquette.
The impossible piece, yeah.
Once you actually hear it, it doesn't sound any more impossible than a lot of 20th century classical music.
Sure.
But is that idea of the unplayable piece, was that something that appealed to you?
Absolutely. And it also creates an incredible climactic moment for the character and for the audience. You know, prior to that, the character's under duress, and any mistake that he makes, you know, during the regular pieces of music, he'll suffer the consequences for as well. And unbeknownst to him, the very piece that he had played 5 years ago, that he had botched in front of a lot of people, that landed him with stage fright in the first place is the very piece that this person, this unknown assailant, wants him to play. So there's already an incredible buildup about the significance of this piece that when it comes time for the character to play it, it's quite a dramatic moment.
Right.
And it's one of the few moments in the film where the camera is not cutting between shots. It starts on Tom playing, and it moves in very slowly. So you get to see the character playing without any cutting for about 3 minutes, which
and
was
it's a solo
daunting
piece.
As hell.
It's a solo piece.
It is
the
a solo
orchestra
piece.
Is out of the picture here.
Correct.
So it's all you.
Correct.
All Tom Selznick, actually. But Elijah Wood is Tom Selznick in the film Grand Piano, and this is part of that climactic scene.
Tom, you hear me? Tom. You're playing beautifully, Tom. You're playing great. But you need to ease up, Tom. You hear me? Ease up. You're gonna tire out your fingers. Careful, Tom. Don't push the tempo. Make sure you hit those last four bars. Tom, if you don't ease up, you're gonna freeze it. You're gonna burn out. You hear me talking to you, piece of shit? Tom, if you don't ease up, you're gonna find bits of your wife's skull in box seat 5.
Shut the f*** up.
So that is Elijah Wood's character, Tom Selznick, playing the impossible piece, La Cinquette.
Yes.
Impossible, and he's got a, you know, sniper's rifle aimed at him and at his wife while
yes.
he's doing it.
Yes, but I think if you, Johannia, the director, likes to say that it's not based on true fact. It's not based on real events. So, yeah, I think the concept is heightened. The reality of the film is slightly heightened. It's not entirely – there are elements that are not entirely believable, but it's one of those things that if you go with it, it sort of takes you away, and
well,
I think that's important.
You could say the same thing about a lot of, you know, Hitchcock.
Sure.
You know, you suspend disbelief. Otherwise, the whole thing, the whole construct falls
apart. It falls apart, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
We're speaking with Elijah Wood, the actor and creator of your own record label. It's an imprint on,
It's on Yep Rock.
On Yep Rock.
It ceases to exist in that form at the moment. It's kind of in flux, the label, at this point.
What was the idea in starting your own label? What were you looking to do?
It honestly was coming out of a place of loving music and wanting to be involved in some way. I don't write music. I don't really play music, but I love it. And it was kind of, as opposed to being just simply a passive music lover and buyer, I wanted to be a part of putting out music that I believe mm-hmm. in. So it really just came from that place. It was pretty naive, really.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly not a business venture. It was probably the worst time to start a record label. But it was exciting. It was exciting to work. I got to work with Apples and Stereo, who are a band that I was a huge fan of as a teenager and into my 20s and still am. And so that was a treat for me.
And the world is made of energy. And the world is electricity.
It was a great experience. It was a great learning experience, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you don't play yourself despite the piano lessons.
I mean, I mess around. With drums. I mess around with piano and guitar. I'm a frustrated non-musician, whereas I understand music, I think, relatively well, considering, you know, the music that I listen to, and I've taken lessons with certain instruments in the past. But I've never got past that yeah. point of actually, you know, of not being able to play but having an understanding. So I can mess around with an instrument and kind of get somewhere, but because I haven't really properly learned, I can't properly play. So,
well,
frustrated non-musician.
As soon as Elijah walked into our soundcheck studio, he spotted our drum kit in the corner and he was back behind it and having a good time within moments. Now, you do some DJing.
I do, yeah.
And recently there was an event celebrating the music of William Onyebor, the Nigerian musician. Was that in London?
It was in London. It was at the Barbican. Yeah.
And you were DJing there.
Yeah. Luwaka Bop released a really brilliant compilation of Onyebor's work last year called Who is William Onyebor?
And who is William Onyebor?
Well, you need to see the documentary.
Yeah.
He's a fascinating, enigmatic individual who sort of disappeared after the mid-80s. His last record came out in like 1985, 1986, and that was it.
He became like a born-again Christian,
and
he didn't want to do music anymore.
Right, and he sort of disappeared, and he's kind of legendary, and so they started... the first piece of music of his to be reissued was on this Nigeria 70 comp that came out, I believe, in 2001, maybe a little bit later. And that caught people's attention. So then people started trying to discover who this person was and what these records were. And the documentary very clearly indicates what that is. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of search for the man, a search for who this person was. And he was an extraordinary artist because at the time, the music of Nigeria was dominated by funk and soul, inspired by Western music. James Brown and the likes. You've got a lot of people like the Funkees and these incredible... you know, Fela Kuti, certainly, and Afrobeat, and all of that. But what Onyebor was doing was completely different. He was basically making like Kraftwerk African records. You know, it was based on drum machines and synthesizers, mm-hmm. which was completely its own thing. So they did an event at the Barbican in London showing the 30-minute documentary, which is online now. And my friend Zach and Fitz and I played African records for the reception after, which was great.
Let's give people a chance to hear some of William Onyebor's music.
Brilliant.
We're speaking with Elijah Wood, who stars in the new film Grand Piano, opening on March 7th, and he DJed at an event celebrating William Onyebor's event in London. Bit of music from the Nigerian musician William Onyebor, an amazing story, kind of a lost giant of African music. Elijah Wood, the actor with me on soundcheck, his new film is Grand Piano, in which he plays a great classical pianist named Tom Selznick. It is a thriller as well, and it's just full of music.
Yes.
The Onyebor thing, though, you know, that music kind of, those sounds are sort of dated. The interesting thing is how, even as you're thinking that, you're thinking, wow, this is kind of great stuff.
Oh, it's incredible. It actually sounds kind of modern. Yeah, it's dated, I suppose. But I find it's so way out and so left field, certainly for the time that it was made. He was way ahead of his time and doing something that kind of confused the audience there.
Yeah.
You know, he talked to a lot of... Apparently, I was speaking to some of the people who have gone to Nigeria and met with him and were part of the research project. Speaking to locals in Nigeria... they kind of didn't really know who he was or care about his music. It's this new discovery that we've all made so far in the distance, and at the time he wasn't as appreciated as he is now, which is kind of wonderful. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about these labels that are reissuing these wonderful people's work, is that it shines a light on some music that deserves to be looked at and listened mm-hmm. to.
Is that how you felt about, you know, Rob Schneider and Apples and Stereo when you started your label? It was like, you know, here's a band that I know was great,
yeah,
but there's a lot of people out there who haven't heard them.
I had that feeling. I mean, I was a fan of their music for years, so, you know, to be able to start a small little imprint with Yep Rock and to work with this band that I've loved for so long... in one level, it was just a selfish, wonderful feeling of getting to work with a band that I love. But also, if there was anything that I could do to help elevate the awareness of this band that I think is important in the rock pop world, and to sort of be given the due that I think that they deserve, then, you know, it was a wonderful thing to be a part of.
Well, then let me give you the chance to boost the profile of someone else. Who are you excited about these days?
There's a band, they're certainly getting some attention. I think they're going to continue, they're going to get more attention coming up. But there's a band out of Sweden called Goat that are an incredible collective of musicians who wear, famously on stage, they wear masks. And they are basically some strange hybrid between sort of Afrobeat, metal, and disco and funk. It's really an extraordinary, they have an album called World Music. It came out a year or two ago. And they're starting to play shows in the U.S. They're really extraordinary, and I'm excited for people to hear them. It's one of my favorite records that I've heard in a while.
Let's hear some. Music from Sweden, from the band Goat. Elijah Wood picking the hits for us on Soundcheck today. So, I mean, obviously, as someone who has lived and breathed music for so long, was it the music angle that drew you into this new movie, into Grand Piano?
I think that was part of it. I think I was also very intrigued at the notion that a good portion of the film was set in real time. You know, it's a thriller. It's a classic construct. I think it will remind people of Brian De Palma and Alfred Hitchcock in the way that it's crafted and constructed. But I thought that it was such a clever thing to have the audience be in an experience where they also were an audience member in the theater themselves in a strange way.
Yeah.
And I think that's just an extremely unique experience and a unique way to deal with a classic sort of thriller construct.
Yeah. The ending will divide viewers.
You think?
I think so. I liked it. My wife loved it. My daughter was like, oh, no!
So you're speaking of the very end.
The final shot.
Sure,
yes.
Sure.
I'm not going to give anything away.
I love the ending. I love the ambiguity of the ending.
Yeah.
I'm a massive fan of not tying everything up, you know, perfectly and succinctly at the end of a film. Especially with a thriller, there's something kind of nice about leaving something to the imagination.
And, you know, some of...
Because what would it be? You know, if we won't... I'll speak about it in a vague sense, but, you know, if we were to have answered it, what would it have been? And would that have actually been more satisfying? I don't really believe it would be.
It's like those horror movies where the ghost you don't see, the monster you don't see,
yes,
is always going to be scarier than whatever thing the special effects department can
absolutely
come up with.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, so the film is Grand Piano. It opens on March 7th. It stars Elijah Wood, who's been with me here in the Soundcheck studio. Elijah, you can come back and play our drum kit or our piano anytime. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Up next, some of you will know Les Claypool as the bass player and frontman for the genre-defying band Primus, but now Claypool and his longtime musical partner Brian Kehoe have teamed up to create Duo de Twang. We'll hear them play live next on Soundcheck.
Now, Jay was a race driver, he goes goddamn fast, he never did win checkered flags, but he never did come in last. Jay was a race driver, he said yes, I'm number one, with the most secrets on 442, he lined him up just for fun.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Some of you will know Les Claypool as the bass player and frontman for the genre-defying band Primus. but he's constantly stretching the sound of what his bass can do on a huge array of projects and partnerships. Claypool and his longtime musical partner, Brian Kehoe, have just released a record under the name Duo de Twang. And they are here in the Soundcheck studio with a twangified version of another Primus song. Here is Winona's Big Brown Beaver live on Soundcheck.
Yes, here we go.
Come out.
There you go. Les Claypool's Duo de Twang, live on Soundcheck with a version of the Primus song, Winona's Big Brown Beaver. Brian Kehoe playing guitar, Les Claypool singing and playing a little tambourine in what looks like a cymbal case. And what is the main axe that you've got here? This is not a normal bass guitar.
This is called a resonator bass guitar.
Just as Brian is playing a sort of steel-plated resonator guitar, you've got the bass version of that.
I do have the bass version, and somebody sent me one of these things years ago, and I looked at it and went, okay, and I stuck it off in the corner, and then I pulled it out for a recording one day, and it sort of stuck with me and continues to stick to me. And then, we decided to start twanging up our songs and other people's songs. And
So did the instrument actually kind of lead you in the direction of this sound?
It did to an extent. I did this soundtrack for this horror film a few years back called Pig Hunt. It was a song called Boonville Stomp where I needed this sort of Deliverance meets Dead Pigs type sound. So
did dead pigs figure prominently in the plot of this movie?
Oh yes, Pig Hunt. You know, hence the name Pig Hunt. No real pigs were killed during the making of the thing,
big,
as far as anyone knows.
It's right. A big monster pig.
Yes, 3,000-pound pig that was terrorizing the pot fields of Northern California. So
terrorizing the pot fields of Northern California, that is a scary prospect.
Yes, of course.
all that good weed being trampled underfoot.
So I needed this swampy, sultry sound, so I busted out the old, I called it the Dobro bass. I busted it out and wrote a song called Boonville Stomp.
Right, which you've re-recorded here. With on the album, with Brian.
I'm at the point in my career where I re-record my stuff. It's easier.
So you're like Bach, who was constantly revising.
Bachman Turner Overdrive. Is that what you mean?
that is what I meant. Yes. Les Claypool's Duo de Twang. The album is called 4 Foot Shack, and it is actually bookended by two Primus songs. There's Winona's Big Brown Beaver, and then. We heard a little bit at the very top of Jerry Was a Race Car Driver, which, if you weren't actually singing the lyrics, I don't think I would have recognized it first time through.
Well, you know, Jerry Was a Race Car Driver has that cadence. You know, I grew up, my stepdad had his old Bakelite radio in the garage, and he was always out there working on his garage. He was a mechanic, and I was working on my bike, and I'd hear all these old, you know, he could put it on what he called the Oki station.
Uh-huh.
So I'd hear all these tunes, and...
Where did you grow up?
In East Bay, east of San Francisco, in sort of a semi-rural community called El Sobrante, which means, roughly translated, means the leftovers in Spanish.
Hmm.
So, hearing these songs and there's this cadence to Jerry Was a Race Car Driver, getting back to that, that's very Charlie Daniels-esque, you know, or esque. So twanging it up seemed pretty logical. In fact, the version of Winona's Big Brown Beaver we just played is actually how Winona's Big Brown Beaver was originally written. It's just I had the lyrics and then I had this, you know, fancy bass part that we melded together for the Tales from the Punchbowl record many years ago.
Right.
So
that being one of the early Primus records, and those of you who perhaps are unfamiliar with Primus, you might not be as unfamiliar as you think because, of course, the theme song to South Park all these years has come from Les and that band. Now, Brian, did you grow up in the same town as Les?
I grew up just a town south in El Cerrito, California, famous for a couple of bands, Creedence Clearwater, and Metallica lived there for a minute.
In El Cerrito?
Yeah.
Okay. Wasn't there a racetrack in El Cerrito as well?
That was in Albany, the Albany racetrack. Right. We caused a lot of trouble down there.
Really?
Oh, boy.
So how long have the two of you been playing together?
Since high school.
Or playing against each other, as the case may be.
I have known him since he was a skinny, long-haired fellow.
Yeah. Now I'm a big guy with a long beard. No hair on top.
And when you guys first started playing together, what were you doing?
Metal.
Progressive hippie metal.
Yeah, kind of pre-thrash.
It was definitely pre-thrash. He had a song called Queen of Swords, which was pretty sweet. It was based on the tarot.
The tarot card of the
song. Oh,
yeah.
And that pretty much sums up the type of music we were playing right there.
That's
right.
It.
And now you're doing this kind of, it's almost like you know, sitting on the front porch kind of stuff.
That's exactly. It's actually, we That's usually have is. A campfire in front of us on stage. We have this campfire.
Right. Thank you for not bringing that into the sound.
Actually, I think you would have enjoyed it. It's a, it adds an element. That's,
yeah, our audience would have increased by about 5 or 6 fire marshals, I think.
Yeah.
But what you do have in between you is, as I said before, it's like a little tambourine on what looks like the case that drummers carry their cymbals around in. Is this like a standard part of the duo de twang?
This is. I became very influenced by a fellow named Stompin' Tom Connors, who passed away this last year at the ripe old age of whatever. And years ago, I was on tour with Oysterhead, and I was flipping the channels in
your, your band with Trey Anastasio.
Trey Anastasio and Stuart Copeland. Right. I see this guy on television, and he's playing the guitar, and he's stomping on this piece of plywood, and he's singing these folk Canadian songs. And it turns out he was the Johnny Cash of Canada. Not a lot of people in the States know about him. So I've been waving the Stompin' Tom flag, and I decided to start stomping, and I got this is the lid to a drum case, and I taped a tambourine to it, and you know, away we go.
All right.
I like to call it the Mississippi drum machine.
I like to call it Steve.
Now, the album, in addition to some of your own stuff and these covers of your Primus stuff as well, there are covers of other people's, and they're pretty eclectic. How did you make those choices?
Some of them were obvious choices. You know, we did a Stompin' Tom tune, which I wanted to do. We did some Johnny Cash. We, you know, live and what's on the record, I'm not sure, but we do some Johnny Cash. We're going to play this Jerry Reed song here for you in a moment, which I grew up loving me some Jerry Reed. And some of it we just stumbled across, you know. We start twanging away, you know. And some words kind of popping, you know, you can tell by the way I use my walk, I'm a woman's man, no time to talk, music loud, you know, little...
Those are the last words that would have popped into my mind.
But
sometimes
things just pop in, you know.
Yeah.
We tried to do Holy Diver by Dio, and we do bits and pieces of it here and there. But a lot of it is just stumbling across things.
Right.
And then if they evolve into full tunage, because the shows themselves are pretty casual. We got the campfire. We usually have some alcoholic beverages. And there's way more there's way more chatter than playing most of the time, for good or ill.
All right, so you do the version of the Bee Gees Staying Alive. You do a really interesting version of the Alice in Chains hit Man in a Box that to me sounds like you're channeling both Ennio Morricone from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Oh, I love that.
And maybe Ghost Riders in the Sky or something like that.
I love that.
I like that. Can we quote you on that?
You may. You're welcome.
I'm going to have that tattooed in my forehead by the end of the day.
I hope Jerry Cantrell feels the same way.
All right, you mentioned Jerry Reed, this song Amos Moses, which is on the record, 4 Foot Shack. How did you find this song?
Well, back in the old days when I was a young little whippersnapper running around listening to my stepdad's Bakelite radio, I was offered by my parents $1 per A that I would get on my report card. Mm-hmm. And needless to say, I didn't get a lot of dollars. But when I did get $1, I would do, which most kids did back in those days, back in the ancient times, I'd go buy a 45.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first, if not the first 45 I ever purchased on my own was Jerry Reed, Amos Moses.
Yes! Here comes Amos! Now, Amos Moses was a Cajun. He lived by himself in the swamp. He hunted alligator for a living. He just knocked him in the head with a stump. The Louisiana law gonna get you, Amos.
And from that point on, I was a big Jerry fan, you know. And, you know, everybody loves Jerry. You can say, you know, hey...
A lot of people did love Jerry. He had a number of hits back in the 70s.
Well, most people think of a different Jerry when I say, hey, we're going to do a tribute to Jerry here, and then we play Jerry Reed. But, you know, he was immortalized in Scooby-Doo episode, which is fantastic. And he wrote some great songs. And he was a hell of a picker. You know, hear him on those Jerry Reed, Chet Atkins records. It's amazing.
All right, you want to do there'll be a little picking going on here in the Soundcheck studio. As Les Claypool and Brian Kehoe, the duo de twang, take on this Jerry Reed song called Amos Moses.
Yes, long live Jerry.
Alligator for living. He just to knock him in the head with a stump. Oh, Louisiana law gonna get you, Amos. It ain't legal hunting alligator down in the swamp, boy. Everybody blamed his old man for making him mean as a snake. Well, Amos Moses was a boy. His daddy'd use him for alligator bait. Tie a rope around his waist and throw him in the swamp. Alligator bait in the Louisiana bayou. About 45 minutes southeast of Tippecanoe, Louisiana, lived a cat called Doc Millsap and his pretty wife, Hannah. Well, they raised up a son that could eat up his weight in groceries. Named him after a man of the cloth. Call him Amos Moses. Now the folks around South Louisiana said Amos was a hell of a man. He could trap the biggest, the meanest alligator and just use one hand. Well, it's all he got left, cause alligator bit it. Left arm gone clean up to the elbow. Now the sheriff got wind of Amos. He's in the swamp trapping alligator skinning. So he snuck in the swamp going to get the boy, but he never come out again. Well, I wonder where the Louisiana sheriff went to. You can show me lost in the Louisiana bayou. About 45 minutes southeast of Tippecanoe, Louisiana, lived a cat called Doc Millsap and his pretty wife, Hannah. Well, they raised up a son that could eat up his weight in groceries. Named him after a man in the cloth. Call him Amos Moses. Lived a cat called Doc Millsap and his pretty wife Hannah. Well, they raised up a son that could eat up his weight in groceries. Named him after a man of the cloth. Call him Amos Moses.
Live on Soundcheck, Les Claypool's duo De Twang. Les Claypool singing and playing his bass dobro, and Brian Kehoe playing the dobro-style guitar. I'm saying dobro. Dobro is a brand name, and neither of these are not actual.
I think now in nomenclature, it is synonymous.
Nomenclature.
You like that as a big word for a big guy?
Nomenclature. we should call this duo de nomenclature.
So, but yes, I mean, in theory, it's like Band-Aid or Xerox.
Right. In the 30s, the Dopia brothers put together the Dobro. They came out of the National Company, and they made Dobros.
They made Dobros. They're resonator guitars. Each of your instruments has what looks like a large metal pie plate.
Called a cone.
Mm-hmm. So some of these are known as, tricone guitars, depending on how many they have,
yep, et
cetera. And these were kind of the first amplified. The whole reason for all the metal and stuff is because they're loud. You can hear them.
I think what happened is that when drums became more popular in American music, especially down south in New Orleans, jazz, ragtime, and horns are loud, they needed the guitar to be louder because a lot of times if there wasn't any drums, the guitar was the drummer.
Right. And now, Les, you've got your instrument, but you've also got two mics in front of you. One is kind of the straight sound, and the other is that, you know, familiar affected sound. Now, have you ever found yourself singing the wrong part into the wrong microphone?
Oh, I do it all the time. This is all part of the game, you know. It keeps, you know,
keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, you know, it's all, everything's all casual. Yeah, this microphone here is actually it's a harmonica mic. And one of my favorite bands of all time, especially in the last 20 years, was a band called Morphine. And I had gotten to know Mark Sandman.
The late Mark Sandman.
Yeah, we were getting to be buddies, and then he passed on. And in tribute to Mark, if you look, my microphone actually says Sandman on it. And I've been using this for years in tribute to him and also, you know, kind of stealing his idea. Because that's what they did.
That's what musicians do.
Let's take a trip together, headlong into the irresistible orbit.
That's a little music from Mark Sandman and the band Morphine, the group that Les Claypool just mentioned. The song's called Let's Take a Trip Together from the Morphine album Cure for Pain. In a moment, we'll hear Les Claypool and Duo De Twang performing again in the studio. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with Duo De Twang, a new project from bass player Les Claypool of Primus and his frequent collaborator, the guitarist Brian Kehoe. Their new album is called 4 Foot Shack, and it features some unusual covers plus reworked versions of some old Primus songs, like this one called Red State Girl. Here's Les Claypool and Duo De Twang live on Soundcheck.
Fingernails lint down between her toes, paint above her eyeballs, and powder on and up in her nose. She got made out of recycled bottles, her hair flipped up in a curl. She wants to grow up to be Sarah Palin. She's a self-proclaimed bona fide red state girl. Girl.
bow, pity bow, bow. Bow, pity bow, bow, pity bow, bow.
That is Les Claypool's duo De Twang live on Soundcheck with a version of Red State Girl, which appears on their album 4 Foot Shack. Once again, Brian Kehoe on guitar, Les Claypool on bass and tambourine and vocals. So, Les, you mentioned just a couple of moments ago, you know, the late, great Mark Sandman, Morphine. I was a fan of that band as well. And there were a lot of really unusual sounds in that band.
Yes.
Many of them created by Mark himself on his slide bass, his two-string bass. Who were the bass players that were kind of formative influences on you?
Well, I mean, in the early days, it was all the standard guys, the Geddy Lees and the John Paul Joneses and the Stanley Clarks and Larry Grahams and, you know, Tony
Jocko.
Levin.
Jocko Pastorius?
You know, I never really went down the Jocko road. I enjoyed Jocko, but I didn't go down that road.
Yeah.
I went for the, you know, those guys.
Yeah.
And, but then later on in life, you know, bass sort of just became the crayon that I pulled out of the box, and that's what I draw the pictures in my head with musically. And so I don't listen to so many bass players, but I'll tell you what, Mark Sandman, over the last 20 years, was a very influential player for me. Just the notion of what he was doing and stepping so far out of the box, and you know, I would hear stories about him from his friends about how he would simplify things to the point of where anybody could play whatever instrument he had. It was just about expressing yourself. I just feel like he was one of the most expressive and soulful and sultry bass players that's come along ever. I really enjoyed his playing.
I hear a voice from the back of the room. I hear a voice cry out, you want something good.
Les, we mentioned before, you know, writing the theme song for South Park, writing the score for your pig-based horror film, whatever that was. What was it called again? Pig Hunt.
My buddy Robert Mailer Anderson, he's an author, wrote Boonville.
Yeah.
He wrote it.
Are you still doing, you know, do you do a lot of kind of scoring work?
If something gets tossed my way that's interesting, you know, it's like the South Park thing. We didn't think it was going to get on TV, let alone be an international, you know, mega sensation. We just thought it was cool, and they were clever fellows. You know, I did the robot chicken theme song because I thought it was cool.
Mm-hmm.
So every now and again, these things come down the pike, and I get a chance to do them.
So what are you doing next? Back to Primus, or
we just got back from a quartet
to Twang, or what?
We're twanging it up around the country. You know, it's the thing about the Twang is it's sort of my vacation band. You know, I get together with my old buddy Kehoe, and we go play some small clubs or bars or small halls or whatever, you know, and a lot of people sitting in.
Mm-hmm.
It's very casual and good times. And then, you know, Primus will probably do some more stuff later this year. We did this whole Wonka thing for New Year's that went really well. So
what was that?
Every New Year's, I've been doing New Year's now for, I think it was my 23rd New Year's in San Francisco. It's either Primus or one of my things. And this year, and there's always a theme, and this year the theme was Willy Wonka, the original Willy Wonka, not the, you know.
Not the Johnny Depp version.
And not the thing that came down the pike a few years ago that was
kind of disturbing. You like the Gene Wilder version.
A Gene Wilder, you know, Jack Albert and
And the Oompa Loompas.
Yeah, and the soundtrack for that is amazing. And we recreated it in sort of our dark and freaky manner, and it actually went incredibly well. Yeah. So there's a possibility that's going to be coming around at some point.
Are you guys limited venue-wise to places that will allow you to bring a campfire?
No. People love a campfire. It's the original television.
All right, so prospective hosts of Les Claypool's Duo de Twang, you have been duly warned. Les, Brian, it's been great having you guys with us on Soundcheck
today.
Thanks,
John.
The album's called 4 Foot Shack. It's out now. This is Soundcheck.
You can tell by the way I use my walk, I'm a woman's man, no time to talk. Music loud and women warm, I've been kicked around since I was born. When it's all right, it's okay, you can look the other way. You can try to understand New York Times effect on man. Whether your brother, whether your mother, you're staying alive, see the city breaking and everybody shaking and we're staying alive, staying alive.
Tomorrow on the show, Roseanne Cash's new album, The River and the Thread, takes inspiration from a series of trips down to Dyess, Arkansas, to help restore her father, Johnny Cash's, childhood home. She'll join us here in the studio to play some of those songs for us live. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.